Lowe's knows that more projects mean more tools. For a limited time, new and existing MyLowe's Rewards credit card members can get 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more, in-store and online. Don't wait to get the things you need. Get special financing today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Now through August 27th, choose 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payments required. See store or Lowe's.com for details.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I feel like I haven't done this podcast in like forever, but I think I was literally just live on Sunday. But anyways, you guys aren't here to listen to me ramble. Great guest lined up today. He's been on the show. I think this is his fourth or fifth time. Anyways, we're going to be talking about Assange, Iran, Israel, some other, geopolitical and even some more federal political stuff, because I know my guest is going to talk about that a lot on the show, and he likes to kind of comment on some of that stuff whenever he can. So regardless, on this channel, I will be posting a video of A Common Crown playing Broken Glass from the Millville Music Festival live on Friday. They'll be premiering at, I think, 11:30 a.m. I'm thinking about doing memberships to the channel so that way people can support financially if they so choose, and putting up a bunch of like live stuff from A Common Crown and whatnot. So be sure to be on the lookout for that. Make sure you hit all the links below to figure out where my guest is, what I got going on in the future, all that good stuff. And Tiger Fitness through the links below to get all your supplements, all that good stuff. And Fox & Sons Coffee, use code Kyle at checkout. And without further ado, let's rock and roll. And returning to the show, my good friend, Dave DeCamp. How you doing, man?
I'm good, Kyle. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Of course. I'm doing well. It's a wonderful day here in Pennsylvania. I'm sure you're probably sweating your ass off down in Virginia right now.
Yeah, it's pretty hot. But I like the heat this time of year. It gets old in August, but right now I'm enjoying it still.
Yeah. My wife and I were just in Atlantic City about a week or two ago, and it was like 40 degrees. I'm like, this really sucks. Like, I went outside. I'm pretty sure I had this shirt on at the time. I'm like freezing. I'm in shorts and a tank top, and we're in Atlantic City, just warm. And then, of course, the day we leave, it's like 70 degrees, and now we come back up here, and I'm sweating my ass off working. So, Yeah, man. Well, there's been a lot of crazy stuff going on in the world. I think it's been almost 40 or 50 episodes in about 5 months since I had you on last.
Oh, wow.
And I obviously October 7th happened, prior to that. So I know we covered that a little bit the last show, but it seems like there's always developments over there ever since the war in Israel broke out. And not that Ukraine is necessarily on the back burner, but it doesn't seem to quite be at the front of everybody's attention as much so anymore. So I guess first things first, as I kind of said in the intro, I know that you've wanted to kind of comment on some of the political stuff recently. What are your thoughts on the presidential race right now between RFK, Biden, and Trump? I mean, I can tell you're already loaded.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been paying too close attention to it lately. The thing that I've really noticed, though, is it seems like Trump and all the Republicans are going to be running basically on like a super pro-Israel platform. You see Trump saying, oh, Biden abandoned Israel because apparently he paused one bomb shipment after sending tens of thousands of bombs and giving them everything they want. So that's something I've noticed. You see the Republicans, it seems like now that Trump's got the nomination in the bag, they're kind of forgetting this whole like America first, idea that they claim to have. And it's just like, super pro-Israel. You see Trump basically gave Johnson, the House Speaker, the blessing to, put forward the Ukraine aid and all that. Mm-hmm. So it seems like that facade has kind of dropped and gone away. And I think when it comes to the issues that Trump needs to kind of campaign on right now to win, I don't really think that that's a priority for him to campaign on, you know, ending wars and stuff. He might still say some good things about, like, you know, we got to end the Ukraine war. I'll end it in a day if I get in office. I think he still does say things like that, but he's also like basically signed off on the Ukraine aid on everything and just saying, oh, we should give them loans, you know, even if they can't. But he said, even if they can't pay it back, then, you know, they could do their best to pay it back, but it's like they're not going to pay it back.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of funny. I know you and I have talked in our little group chat about Michael Tracy, and I've just been absolutely loving following him recently because he's been so spot on with just about everything. Because the Trump's big claim to fame over the last couple of years is that, oh, this would have never happened under my watch. And, you know, I'll end the war in a day, just like you said. And then at the same time, Trump kind of gets like credit for both. Like, he gets credit for saying that he's going to end the war, but then he also gets credit for sending in aid. So it's like, I kind of like thought about this a little bit earlier today. I'm like, Trump literally just like plays all sides of everything at all times. So that way he's always a winner, and people who like him are going to love him for everything he does. And people who hate him are just going to hate him for everything he does. It's kind of wild to watch.
Yeah. I mean, he, you know, plays both sides of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. That's kind of just been him. And, you know, it's, I wonder how these people square, like Trump supporters square all the stuff that he says. Like, you know, he did that interview with Tucker during the GOP debate that he didn't participate in. Yeah. And, you know, Tucker was asking about the CIA, and he's like, oh, there's a lot of very good people in the CIA, you know, and Epstein, oh, very sad, you know, that he died. And like, and he's still, you know, all about the vaccine. So, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, he represents something, and I think Biden has no chance right now. I mean, things could change, but it'll be entertaining at least to see if they, you know, their debate. I mean, it's going to be nuts.
Yeah. So, I got to say, out of everything, I'm definitely looking forward to another Trump Biden debate. I think that's kind of where Trump hamstringed himself in 2020, because I think our mutual friend Dave Smith had put it in the respect of, you kind of have to let Biden hang himself. Like, if you just let him talk, everybody's going to see what he's doing. But if you go after him in usual Trump fashion, like Trump likes to do, is to kind of go for the jugular, you look like you're beating up on an old senile man. And I think that's the impression that a lot of people got in 2020. Now, at this point, I think it's like, okay, well, we see Biden can't run anything at all. And his foreign policy has been an absolute disaster. It's been escalate everywhere at all times, anytime you get the opportunity. And Trump has a lot more of that diplomat-esque kind of persona, or at least, and he's definitely sold himself as that. So I think that when it comes to a lot of the foreign policy blunders, I think people are going to look to Trump in a lot more of a favorable light, even though generally he got rolled or just, you know, completely went with, you know, the worst people to negotiate on his behalf. I think that he's at least marketed himself as like a good negotiator.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that he always says when he's asked about Ukraine is, oh, this never would have happened if I was president. And yeah, I think that actually works on a lot of people. I think a lot of people say, oh, yeah, you're right. This, you know, you have this mess in Israel and Gaza now. This never would have happened if Trump was president. I think that's how a lot of people think. Mm-hmm. So well, another thing that's not looking good is that, you know, it looks like he's considering some pretty horrible people for his cabinet.
Shocker.
Yeah. I know there's rumors of, you know, like Marco Rubio for VP. I forget the other guy's name, the senator.
Marco Rubio, Tim Scott was another
one. Tim Scott. Yeah. And then he said on a radio interview, this is actually something you mentioned, Michael Tracy. He's been kind of relentless in his criticism of Trump, but he posted a clip where the, you know, person floated like Tom Cotton, Mike Pompeo,
yep,
as potential picks. And Trump basically said, everybody you mentioned is being considered. Mm-hmm. And Pompeo, I mean, is like the worst, you know, about as bad as you can get. And there's rumors I've heard that he might be considered for Secretary of Defense. Mm-hmm. And Pompeo, I mean, you know, him and Trump never had a falling out. And Pompeo was his head of the CIA. He was the one who plotted to kill Julian Assange. He did all sorts of awful stuff as the head of the State Department. I mean, I didn't think I would hate a Secretary of State more than Pompeo, but then Blinken came along and like, man, Blinken, they're basically the same, do the same things, but like just completely different styles. At least with Pompeo, like, you know what you're getting. Mm-hmm. And then with Blinken, he puts on this like, he's like just kind of the liberal version of that, I guess. It's just, man. But if Pompeo is Secretary of Defense, I mean, that would be a sign that none of these wars are going to end, that, you know, they're just going to continue.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. And I noticed this when I think it was like some Republican Jewish coalition had said Trump was the most pro-Israel president. And when you just like zoom out and look at it, Biden and Trump really aren't that far apart on the vast majority of issues. I think like immigration, they may have a little bit of difference. But one thing that you've pointed out and that I try to point out to the best of my ability is that like when it comes to China, specifically like trade wars and stuff, Biden's been way worse than Trump. I mean, he just announced that plan recently. I tried to post the video, but it didn't work, of Rand Paul going back and forth with Anthony Blinken, funny enough, about tariffs. And Anthony Blinken said something to the degree of like, oh, well, we've tried both ways with China. So, you know, we just have to go in all in on tariffs. And Rand said something like, well, no, we haven't tried both ways. You know, Trump and Biden both aligned here. He said Biden was riding on the Trump train or something like that with the tariffs. And, you know, Biden had just completely ramped up the tariffs on China, which just strategically, anybody with any kind of common sense knows that tariffs don't work.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that, what Rand Paul had to say there. Because he's right. It's like, and I remember because I was covering this for antiwar.com at the time when like the Senate hearings were going on for to confirm Blinken and Yellen and like all of Biden's cabinet officials. The one thing that they were like saying Trump got right was China. Some of them said Trump wasn't tough enough on China.
Yeah.
So it's not a surprise. He never lifted any of the tariffs. He just increased a whole bunch of them. You put 100% tariff on Chinese electric vehicles, which the US doesn't really import many Chinese electric vehicles, but still that's, you know, that means
that's a lot.
Yeah, that's might as well just ban the import of Chinese electric vehicles. And we've seen, you know, a lot of stuff that was started under Trump come to fruition under Biden when it comes to the China stuff. This whole thing, their whole thing is like alliance building. Mm-hmm. And that is something like Blinken and them are better at than Pompeo and Trump were. Just recently, Biden hosted the leader of Japan and the Philippines. They're starting this new like three-way alliance there. And then they have all these new little alliances. One is called the Squad. That's the newest one. That's the Philippines, Japan, Australia, and the U.S. Then you also have the Quad, which is India in there. And so that's really been ramping up. It's been going unnoticed, but tensions have been really high in the South China Sea with the Philippines and China. So that's all still going on, even though like most of the focus right now is on Gaza and Ukraine, which for good reason, but this, you know, they haven't dropped these plans. And there's certain people that Trump might bring in, like this Elbridge Colby guy, who his whole thing is like, we got to get ready for a war with China over Taiwan. Like that's his number one priority. We might have some people that say, all right, you kind of disengage from Ukraine or pull back, make them make some kind of peace deal. But still, you know, they're still going to want to support Ukraine to some extent. I think there's a chance that could happen. It's not going to be good, whatever it is. I mean, and anybody who thinks, you know, Trump just wants to get elected, that's all he cares about.
Yeah. You mentioned the Squad there. How's that different from AUKUS? Because isn't AUKUS like Australia and the US and some of those other countries over there?
So AUKUS is the US, Australia, and the UK.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that's like a that's all about like arms, like technology sharing, so they can like make weapons together, and it's nuclear powered submarines that Australia is going to get in like a few decades. They're going to spend like hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars on it. You know, they're not going to get their first. The idea is to get Australia the ability to make nuclear powered submarines. And according to the plan, that's not going to happen until like 2055. So it's a very long term plan, but they are selling them some submarines in the meantime. But it is preparation for war with China. I mean, that's explicitly why they're doing all this stuff. So,
Okay, so one thing that I know you and I have talked about a little bit, our friend Conrail 2020, Haley said today she will vote for Trump. Conrail, if you could find a link or something like that, or tell me what to Google to pull that up, I would actually really like to see that, because I know Dave and I were both kind of bidden, saying that like there is a large possibility that Trump could pick Haley as his VP, because like there was a little bit of a falling out when she ran for president, but like I think people are hyping that up a lot more than actually like it was. I still think that's a total possibility. People don't want to consider it, but if yeah. he ran Haley as VP, you have that woman there for, you know, all the women that may like think that he's a little bit too crass. She could really get a lot of like the more swampier DC types and a lot more moderates by running with a woman. So I think, and Steve Bannon said that he was going to pick a woman. So I think there is some evidence.
I think it's possible. I mean, I still think it's possible. There was like some report recently, I think from Axios, that said she was being considered. Trump denied it. But he said like, oh, you know, best wishes to Nikki Haley. You know, it's like they're cordial now again. So, yeah, it's not surprising to hear Nikki Haley say that. And of course, you know, you have the neocons or whatever you want to call them, like people like Nikki Haley, Mike Pompeo, the ones that are like ready to adapt for Trump to make sure that they don't that they can still be in power. You know, so I think I definitely think it's a possibility that she might have some position. She was his ambassador to the UN for a little while when he was president. So,
Okay. So I guess we should kind of move on to Julian Assange there, because I don't think I've really talked about it a lot on this channel. I know when you gave a speech in DC, I think it was an Assange rally actually, if I remember correctly, and it's on your channel. So people should go check that out. It was a really, really good speech. Start with the kind of who is Julian Assange, what did he do, and what is kind of like the current status, so kind of like the full picture here.
Yeah, so I mean, for those who don't know, Assange started WikiLeaks, and the most kind of what they're most well known for is publishing that collateral murder video that showed, you know, the U.S. Bombing Reuters journalists and killing them. And that was part of the Iraq and Afghan war logs that were published by WikiLeaks. And that's what they're trying to put him away for. So he's been charged under the Espionage Act for doing journalism. His source was Chelsea Manning, who leaked all these documents, and also the State Department cables. It's known as Cablegate was the big release. That was a huge dump. And it's still like such a good resource that you could search through. And so the allegation is that, you know, I mean, basically what they're doing is trying to charge him. They indicted him under the Espionage Act for receiving classified documents from a source and publishing them, which is journalism. It's very basic journalism. He did it in maybe a more unconventional way by kind of just dumping, you know, the way that they would publish like everything. But a lot of it they did with the New York Times, with the Washington Post, with the Guardian. So that's, you know, what's at stake is that if Assange is extradited to the U.S. and convicted, that then, you know, that sets the precedent. Such a bad precedent for the First Amendment and just freedom of the press. And, you know, he was held up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for years before he was actually arrested. And people all called him, you know, paranoid and crazy that he thought the U.S. was going to go after them. And then in 2019, the British cops dragged him out of the embassy and on behalf of the United States. And he's been held in London's Belmarsh prison ever since then for over 5 years, awaiting the results of this extradition. So the U.S. is trying to extradite him. So anyway, where we're at now is they just had a hearing. So I'm just trying to figure out how to explain it from about the latest thing without going too far back. But basically, Assange tried to appeal. So his legal team made the case to appeal the British Home Secretary's decision to extradite him to the U.S. So they did decide that he can be extradited to the U.S. and put on trial. His team attempted to appeal it, and the London High Court came back and said, here are some grounds that you can appeal this on. One of them was the risk of him getting the death penalty in the U.S. And the other one was the risk of him not being given First Amendment rights because he is not American. And that's another big detail here, is he's an Australian citizen. He's not even American. And the U.S. is trying to extradite him and lock him away. So because the espionage charges, he faces up to 175 years in prison. So life in prison. So then the court said, OK, well, if the U.S. gives us assurances that, you know, we don't have to worry about this thing, then we'll extradite him. So the U.S. gave assurances that he wouldn't get the death penalty, and the court accepted that. But they didn't accept the assurances on the First Amendment. So now, just the other day, just this week, the court ruled that he can appeal under the First Amendment concerns. And so it's a victory in a way. I mean, it is a victory that he didn't get extradited, but this is a long drawn out process. It's not clear, you know, it's going to take months and months, possibly even years again. And he is still locked up in Belmarsh on no charges. And he's in very poor health condition. His family is afraid he could die. So, you know, the thing that we need to happen is for the U.S. to drop the charges so he can be set free. And there's all this talk of like a possible plea deal, but even that, if there's a kind of plea deal where he pleads guilty and doesn't have to do any time, that still could criminalize journalism. That could still set the bad precedent. And I know people who know Assange say that he wouldn't accept that. So, you know, we'll see how things move forward, but there's been more attention on the case lately. And I think this was actually the result that Biden, who knows what he's thinking, but that Biden's team, probably wanted, because if he was extradited right now, that means there would be a journalist like in chains in the United States going on trial for doing journalism, which anybody can see that looks at this case, that that's what it is, that the allegations that he helped Chelsea Manning like break into something. It's just like nothing beyond a journalist, you know, encouraging a source to give them information. And also the allegations that the WikiLeaks put people in danger or whatever, that was all dealt with in Manning's trial. And they never found any evidence that anybody was killed or anything because of the information that they published. So, yeah, I think, you know, that would be a really bad look for Biden with the election coming up if he's trying to, you know, putting a journalist on trial for doing journalism.
Yeah, it seems like he would probably want to kind of kick the, or, you know, punt the ball on this one and kind of wait until either he wins or loses in, you know, at the end of this year to kind of see if he should to make a decision on that. You know, I know it's amazing to me how many attacks on the First Amendment there are, especially with the anti-BDS legislation, all these Republican governors, no less, going after these college students who are protesting the war in Gaza. You would think that Republicans, when their you know, enemy class is in charge, they would want to kind of give incentives to their constituents to vote for their team. But instead, they're saying, no, it's illegal to criticize a foreign government, which is just absolutely insane to me. And this kind of, you know, encircles with the whole Julian Assange deal, where basically, you know, standard journalistic procedures would be literally criminalized. So it's insane to consider, and it doesn't seem like either one of those issues gets a lot of attention.
There's been a lot more attention lately on the anti-Semitism laws, that because so the House just passed that big bill that everybody's been talking about, that basically defines anti-Semitism as criticism of Israel, and those that has been passed at the state level in a lot of states. I think
38.
Those are the BDS laws.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah.
So this is kind of different. The you know, states adopting this, what is it, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance or whatever, their definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. So I know there's been at least 8 states that have codified that definition into law. And that means that that definition can be used when prosecuting people for discrimination. Mm-hmm. So that does mean you can end up getting arrested or something for, if they using that definition of the law for criticism of Israel or something like that. That was Kristi Noem just signed that into law recently. So it's crazy, you know, when people start looking into that stuff. Even the anti-BDS laws are also insane. Basically, what those do in some of the states where they've been passed is that if you're like a contractor entering a contract with the state, you have to sign loyalty oath to Israel. It says in your contract that you have not ever and will never boycott Israel. Mm-hmm. And a few of these cases became really public when, you know, in one case in Texas, it was a substitute teacher and she was Palestinian American. And she looks at her contract and it says, you know, you will never boycott Israel. And she's like, what? And, you know, whenever it goes to the courts, you know, of course, mm-hmm. that's, you know, completely unconstitutional. And it happened to Abby Martin. She was supposed to speak at a, you know, I guess it was a state university in Georgia. And so she made a public case about it, which, you know, and so I think because of that, they increased the threshold. Then it was like she was getting like $1,000 for the speech. Mm-hmm. Now, I think in some of the states, at least they made it like if your contract is for like $30,000 or more or just like higher amounts. Because so and then the other aspect of that is you saw this with Ben and Jerry's. Ben and Jerry's said they were going to stop. All they said they were going to do was stop selling ice cream in the occupied Palestinian territories, which basically means in settlements in the West Bank. And the Israeli officials went on the offensive and they called up American governors and said, enforce your BDS laws against Ben and Jerry's, which is Unilever, which is a British conglomerate that owns Ben and Jerry's now. And what they did was in several states, they divested from Unilever, their pension funds, basically. They divest, you know, to punish them for what Ben and Jerry's did. You know, it's completely insane. I covered that a lot because it was just like, it's just so crazy, but it still didn't get much attention. Unilever ended up selling Ben and Jerry's rights in Israel to an Israeli company to just be done with the problem. But anyway, yeah, these are things that, man, you know, more people need to be aware of.
Yeah, I almost hate kind of talking about this kind of stuff, and I'm sure you know where I'm about to go with this, but because I think a lot of people's ears and eyes kind of open real wide, and they think that you're going down the 1940s Austrian painter route because you're talking about a group of people. And it's like, no, this has nothing to do with a specific group of people. This has to do with our government basically clamping down on the freedoms of Americans on behalf of a foreign government, which is absolutely insane to me. And a story that I know you ran this week was about actually my representative, my congressman, Guy Reschenthaler, and a congressman from Ohio, I think it was, that wanted to extend military benefits to people who served in the IDF to have the same benefits, you know, that American soldiers would get. So do you want to expand upon that?
Yeah, it's completely insane, this bill. This is one of those things like almost unbelievable. So you mentioned, how do you say his name? Guy Reschenthaler?
Yeah, Reschenthaler.
And then it was Max Miller, who he's a Republican, you know, an America First Republican from Ohio. They introduced the bill. And what the bill would do is it would extend like protections, benefits under certain U.S. laws that protect, you know, jobs for Americans in the military. Mm-hmm. You know, it's mostly used for, say, you're in the reserves and you work a regular civilian job and then you get called to active duty and the law, you know, makes it so they can't fire you or so that you don't lose your health benefits when you come back to your job. There's also another law that like you can't get your house, foreclosed on or like get your possessions repossessed or get like divorced, basically, while you're on active duty. And for up to a year after that. So it would extend those protections for Americans in the IDF, which is just, I mean, wow. Just like, you just can't even imagine anything like that for another foreign country. So yeah, and I don't really know what the chances are, what chances it has to pass. There's been, you know, what we're seeing right now is basically the Republicans are introducing all these bills, these super pro-Israel bills to be like, see how pro-Israel we are, you know, we're the pro-Israel party as the elections are coming up. So they get more donations and everything. You know, we saw, what's his name? I forget who introduces Andy Olgers. He's an, he introduced a bill to send the college protesters to Gaza, which I mean, it's just like completely absurd, but he introduced a bill that says to do that. I mean, it's completely insane. And what he said in his statements on it was basically like, oh, I don't think they'll last a week there. So what he's essentially saying is that these college kids should be killed in Gaza because they're protesting against Israel. I mean, it's just like, man,
it's been so bizarre to watch people's reactions to this kind of stuff. And I think the one the point that I've tried to make, and hopefully it's sunk in for people who saw it, but just to think about like 2020 and all of the insanity that happened in the summer of 2020 and how nothing was done, but kids protest a foreign government, and yeah, they're being loud, rowdy assholes. Should they be protesting the way they are? We could debate that, but that's not the point. Our government literally sent the military in to stop some of these protests. I mean, you literally see full-on people in combat suits shutting down these protests on a college campus. But when people's cities and homes and businesses were burning in 2020, not a cop to be found. It is mind-boggling to me. And I think people who are very, very pro-Israel would do themselves a favor to almost put the shoe on the other foot and ask, what if the Democrats were doing this for China? What if they were sending in, or what if, you know, basically they were doing all the stuff on behalf of China? Republicans would lose their goddamn minds, and reasonably so, but like, it's a foreign government that we're literally shutting down our own, you know, people's freedoms over. It's so bizarre to me.
Yeah, I mean, like what's his name? Greg Abbott, the Texas governor. He's basically said, you know, when they sent in the state troopers to bust up one of the protests in Austin, like, you know, this has to stop because they're anti-Semitic, you know, not because they're destroying property or anything, or because they're occupying the college. No, because they're anti-Semitic, which it's not anti-Semitic protests. It's clearly not when you have so many Jewish students involved. Like during Passover, there was Passover Seders at the protests. It's like, this is where the Jewish students say they're so unsafe. But yeah. And I think the difference is pretty shocking. Like it's such a big difference between these protests and the summer of the BLM riots and stuff. And cause I live near Richmond. I moved down like right after there was really big riots, and like, it was pretty depressing. The main street just boarded up. You know, all these windows smashed and everything. There was like serious riots there. Yeah. And then at VCU, which is the college in the city, some students like camped out at the library for Gaza.
Yeah.
One for a day. And that night the cops showed up, tear gassed them, and just brutally broke it up in one day. It's like, wow, it's just amazing. And I know the governor is like very pro-Israel. So not really a surprise, but that contrast and just how quickly they said, no, these aren't happening. And you saw how the mayor, Eric Adams, responded in New York. It's just like, yeah, there's clearly a difference in the response.
Right. Well, when it comes to your constituents versus a foreign government, I want to read some of these comments real quick. You got a lot of love coming your way. Shane Swenson, iconography. Oh, nice. Yeah, Dave Rules.
Yeah, Shane Rules.
Yeah, nice. Adam, good to see you, brother. And conflicts of interest, I'm guessing that's either Kyle or Connor.
Yeah.
Dave is great. shows how Antifa and BLM served a purpose rather than it being they were taking over in 2020 and 2021. Another point that I think you and I could make that I think would be poignant is that there's this very, very weird dynamic of Democrats supposedly being like anti-Israel or something like that, but it's just objectively not true because Biden is the largest recipient of AIPAC aid ever, or AIPAC donations. Hillary Clinton, I think, is number two or three, and Bob Menendez is like number two or three. I know the top three are literally Democrats that receive money from AIPAC, and even like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has gone full just mask off, unhinged neocon over the war in Israel. My understanding is she hasn't even received any money from Israel, but she's still going all in on this stuff. So, I mean, it's just insane to me the influence that people have. But my point here is just that, like, the idea that Democrats are anti-Israel, it just doesn't seem to be a lot of truth to that. So that's not really a question, but I know you could probably address some of that a little bit further.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned in my show yesterday, I put it in kind of a silly way, but I was like, the Republicans are like the super, super pro-Israel party. That's what they're platforming. That's what kind of their platform is for the elections. Mm-hmm. And that the Democrats are just like the super pro-Israel party. But we have seen, there has been a change recently that there is a small number of Democrats in the House that are really anti aid to Israel, who really are against it. And that's kind of, you know, the squad or whatever. But you've seen even there's been like a few dozen, I think 50 something sent a letter to President Biden telling him to end military aid to Israel because it's against the U.S. foreign assistance laws, because, you know, which they're just completely flouting. So there is like a little more opposition among the Democrats.
Yeah,
but it's not that. It's kind of like the Ukraine opposition to the Ukraine war among the Republicans. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not nothing, but it's also not enough to like really change anything.
Yeah,
because there's also just super, super pro-Israel Democrats. I mean, to like the same level as these people introducing these bills, like John Fetterman, your guy over there. I mean, he's just like completely all in, like, you know, it has to be completely unconditional, all the aid to Israel.
And yeah, it's funny because Republicans have basically come out and endorsed him. I remember Donald Trump Jr. of all people.
When he's they all love him now.
Oh yeah. He was running victory laps for John Fetterman because he specifically said, oh yeah, he's super pro Israel. I'm like, oh
yeah,
you come on. You guys are falling over yourself for John Fetterman. But sorry, yeah.
And then Richie Torres is one I always think of. He's a Democrat from New York in the House. Just completely. And he's a big AIPAC. You know, he's one of the heavy hitters when it comes to the AIPAC money. Mm. But yeah, and you know, this calculation, it's really hard to know, to say like what's going to happen in Gaza in the next few months between now and November. Mm-hmm. But you know that's definitely Netanyahu. That's definitely part of his calculations, is that like, all right, if I can get through this Democratic administration, you know, Trump comes in, then I could just do whatever I want. And they're not going to like worry about aid and stuff. They're just going to say, you know, here's everything, you know, do whatever you want. Here's everything you need. Get it done quick, I think is going to be what Trump says.
Yeah, so. Well, I think Trump kind of sees the disaster that's playing out on Biden's hand. And I think Trump wouldn't be, I think he would still want it to be kind of, like you said, cleaned up a little bit quicker. But there's also, like you said, everybody saying Biden's leaving Israel behind. But I mean, Israel has essentially ran roughshod over Biden because he told them, hey, don't go into Rafah. But they kind of just said, all right, well, okay, whatever. But then they went ahead and did it anyways. And now you saw somebody that I remember people just touting out as this great anti-war hero, Corey Mills putting forth articles of impeachment over Biden holding up aid to Israel. But so, much like you said, you know, rest in peace to the anti-war right on, I want to say it was October 7th, you tweeted that out. But talk about that a little bit and kind of how Biden's relationship with Israel has been ever since October 7th.
Yeah, well, with the Rafah thing, you know, it did seem like Israel wanted to go in there like they did in the other cities, like Gaza City, Khan Yunis, and just completely destroy it. Yeah. They did. But this idea really that Israel went against Biden and invaded Rafah anyway isn't true. Biden gave him the green light, basically, when they went to capture the Rafah border crossing. He spoke with Netanyahu a few hours before and told him, yeah, you could do that. You know, we won't oppose that. And that goes, you know, all this talk, because, you know, going back to those foreign assistance laws. So you're not supposed to give military aid to countries that use U.S. weapons to violate international law and that block humanitarian aid shipments. And Israel's obviously doing both of those things, but they're claiming, you know, the State Department's like, well, it's really amazing, this report that they had to put out on it, because they said, yeah, Israel, it looks like they probably are violating international law, but there's no proof. So we're just going to keep giving them weapons. And like, how is there no proof? Like, it's just crazy. But then the aid thing. So they're claiming that Israel's doing enough to let aid in, but then they capture the border crossing where the most aid, you know, by far is going in. It was the only aid crossing open for a while. And that's been shut off for like almost 2 weeks now. And the UN just shut down the food distribution in Rafah. So it's like, so all that talk about aid was just completely meaningless. And they started this pier. Do you know about this U.S. built pier that's supposedly for aid?
Yeah,
it costs $320 million. It's basically like a floating dock that they built off the coast of Gaza, and they to get aid in, instead of just pressuring Israel to open more border crossings. So they opened it on Friday and they got a few trucks in, but then people just started like looting the trucks, because there's no, in that area of Gaza, there's just Israel's killed all the police and everything, and like there's just no way to distribute it from there. So it's just a complete mess. So it's, they spent all this money on it. They got a few trucks in and now it's closed. Like it's just crazy. Like if you look at what they're doing on paper, it's like the Biden says that Israel's letting enough aid in so they could keep giving them weapons, but we also have to drop aid from the sky. And now we have to build this pier to get aid in, but yeah, they're still letting it, like, it's just completely ridiculous. But Biden is, you know, he's all in, even this talk, like it's just all a PR move, like pausing the bomb shipment and saying what he said about Rafah. He's completely all in on helping Israel. He just wants them to do it in like a less, you know, Netanyahu and his government are just not good for like the PR campaign at all. Like they just, they say too much, you know, what they want to do too freely. And Biden doesn't like that, but ultimately he's all in on giving them whatever they want.
Yeah, that's why it's always been kind of funny to me. And it's like a weird thing for both sides, because it's like, okay, well, you know, a lot of the younger Democrats, I don't think the older Democrats, but like a lot of the younger Democrats and younger liberals kind of look at Biden and say like, we don't like this policy that you have on Israel. But then, you know, the right wingers are all saying, oh, well, we don't like his policy on Israel because he's not doing enough for it. But like you said, I mean, Joe Biden has been a very, very fervent Israel supporter his entire political career. So, and like you said, he greenlighted the invasion into Rafah. He kind of wants it to be like, hey, you just got to be a little bit quieter about this. It almost reminds me of like the Ukraine aid stuff, where basically all he told Zelensky is like, you just need to be a little bit more grateful. Like, say thank you every once in a while for all the aid. You can't just keep taking and taking and taking. Like, we need to know you at least appreciate what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is crazy the way like the attitude of the Ukrainian officials are just like, it's not enough. Send us more. It's like, how much more could they send? But yeah, so again, one thing I think the U.S. is thinking right now, you know, and there's been a few reports on this, is I think they're trying to like locate Sinwar, the leader of Hamas in Gaza. So I think if like he gets killed, and then they could say, all right, it's a victory, end it, you know, because they're not defeating Hamas. Hamas is growing, apparently. That's what U.S. intelligence thinks, that Israel's only killed between 30-35% of Hamas's fighters, which was estimated to be at like 30,000 before October 7th. But they've recruited thousands more. Again, according to U.S. intelligence, which is believable, because when you wipe out someone's entire family, I mean, what are they going to do? They're just going to, you know, like if any young man who is experiencing the things that are happening in Gaza.
How could you not be radicalized?
Yeah. Or just even if it's not Hamas, there's other groups who just pick up a rifle. Like, you know, that's going to happen, of course. So even though they're just completely destroying Gaza, they still have this tunnel infrastructure, and that hasn't really been destroyed. So it's just like a mess, you know. They completely have annihilated the place, but they still haven't beat Hamas. And so I think the U.S. is thinking like, okay, kill the leader, and then you could say that you have a victory, and then we could negotiate something here. But I don't know if they could find him. I mean, they're thinking that he might not even be in Gaza, that he might have escaped. You know, if I was Hamas, I think like one PR move that they could do. So the ICC just issued, you know, the arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, the Israeli defense ministers. This is the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. And they also issued arrest warrants for Sinwar and what's his name? Daif, the leader of the Hamas's military wing. Mm-hmm. And then the political leader who's in Qatar. If I was one of them, I'd be like, all right, I'll go stand trial. Like, because I think right now Hamas, even though for how brutal October 7th was, they're winning the global PR war, you know, right. The Palestinians in general, but also Hamas, you know, like, and it would just, I think, you know, considering their attitude, like they're willing to die. I'm sure one of them might be willing to go sit in jail in the Netherlands. It can't be that bad. Probably better than being in Gaza right now.
Yeah, I think on top of that, if let's say, what's the Hamas leader's name? I'm sorry.
Sinwar.
Sinwar. If Sinwar were to come out and then face trial or something like that, then not only would he would be seen as like a martyr, right? So then you could get more people to your cause, and it might kind of take the heat off of them because people are gonna think, oh, look, the leader's done, so that must mean we've tactically defeated Hamas. So that would be a good move for them. But you know that is, you know, I don't know much about him, so maybe he wouldn't want to do that. But you know that, you know, Gallant isn't going to do anything because he's probably, you know, to the right of Netanyahu. Because my understanding is, and it seems to be the same way with a lot of these more militaristic operations, that usually like the leader, the president, is nowhere near as hawkish to the people in his cabinet. You know, like with Putin or Xi, where like a lot of their underlings are kind of want them to be a little bit more aggressive.
Yeah, Gallant just kind of came out against Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. Just about the lack of like a plan and what it seemed like, you know, he was saying that you have to say you're not going to like militarily occupy Gaza forever. But I think that was a response to the fact that they had to go back into northern Gaza to fight Hamas, even though they like completely obliterated that area and said that it was clear. And then they leave and then they pop back up again. And I think it was like over frustration with that. Uh-huh. And we've seen leaks that like, yeah, you have these guys that they want to just completely decimate Gaza and expel all the Palestinians. But there have been leaks from like high level Israeli military officials who say there's like no path here for a military victory and the release of the hostages. It's like either you get one or the other. You completely decimate Gaza and kill everybody and kill all the hostages, which I think most of them are dead. So, yeah, there's definitely like the realization that they can't defeat Hamas. But then you have the other side of it that they, you know, there are Israeli officials who are openly saying, you know, get all the Palestinians out, let's take over and build new Jewish settlements. And they are slowly taking over bits of land. Like they're creating what they call a buffer zone, like on the border of Gaza and Israel. And they're just decimating everything, completely flattening it. So, you know, I think they might just want to keep encroaching that way. But again, it's tough to say like what's going to happen in the next few months. Because Netanyahu is really not in a good position, but he wants to just keep this thing going. And, you know, that's in his interest. If there was like a ceasefire hostage deal, it would be really hard for him to restart. So I don't know.
Yeah. From our friend Abrogate D's, I'm detecting a lot of noticing. You guys are the best. Come to Porkfest. Yeah, dude, I totally wish I could. You should definitely come, Rich, if you're listening. Go to the Ron Paul Institute, because I know that our friend here, Dave DeCamp, is going to be speaking at the Ron Paul Institute event. I don't know if I was supposed to announce that or not, but I know you'll be a part of it, and I'll be there too. So I'm looking forward to going down there to hang out.
Yeah. I don't know if not all the details are like confirmed, but it should be the end of August for their conference in DC, and I didn't go this past year, but I went the year before and it was awesome. I mean, it's like the people that go there, and I'm sure Porkfest is awesome. I do have to get there eventually. Yeah. I probably can't this year. I'm going on a big vacation next month, actually, to Australia. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do need to get to Porkfest eventually, but the Ron Paul Institute conference is going to be great. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just going to things like that, it's good for you.
Yeah, no, dude, I completely agree. So let's close out here on Iran. What is the situation with Iran right now? I know there was that strike a couple weeks ago, and then obviously Abraham Raisi, if I said his name correctly, was killed by the helicopter crash, and there were some other officials in there. What's the situation there, and what do you think this looks like diplomatically for Iran and the U.S.'s and Israel's response? So I know I threw a lot at you there, but good.
Yeah, so I mean, as of right now, Iran is essentially saying that it was an accident because of a technical nature, the helicopter crash. The timing was like, you know, considering everything that's going on, of course it made me very suspicious, you know, when the story first came out. And I definitely still am, because, you know, people need to understand, like, Israel has a very long history of carrying out assassinations and sabotage attacks inside Iran. They've assassinated nuclear scientists. They've assassinated IRGC officials. They planted explosives. They've been able to plant bombs in underground nuclear facilities, you know, so they have their ways. They have their intelligence assets there. But again, you know, we're not seeing Iran say that. Basically, that they were flying in an old U.S. made helicopter, and in some bad weather in a very mountainous area. So, you know, how this is going to impact Iran? You know, the Ayatollah is ultimately in charge anyway. So there's going to be new elections. I don't think it's really going to change Iran's like stance. You know. What they're doing foreign policy wise, like in Iraq, Syria, and everything. Apparently there were some back channel talks going on between the US and Iran kind of about easing tensions, and this has kind of disrupted that, but they might be able to restart that anyway. You know, Raisi, everybody calls him a hardliner in the US. You know, that's kind of how he's portrayed.
Right.
And just based on how his foreign policy has been with the US, he wasn't much different than Rouhani, who he replaced, who was really trying to get back into the nuclear deal. Raisi did put some effort into that as well, even though it didn't go anywhere. But yeah, the situation now, you know, we've seen Israel starting to ramp up airstrikes in Syria again. So then there's always the risk of escalation with that if they kill Iranians, because Israel kills Iranians in Syria pretty frequently. But what they did back in April was a whole nother level, bombing the Iranian consulate, you know, in the middle of the day, killing a very senior Iranian general, Quds Force general. So I don't know if they're going to do anything like that again, but there's always a chance of that exploding. But it did seem like things have eased a bit between Iran's, you know, allies in Iraq and Syria, and the U.S. and Israel. But at the same time, you also have the situation on the border with Lebanon and Hezbollah that continues. You know, they've been bombing each other every day just about, and the Houthis are still at it, but the Houthis are not really under any sort of control by Iran, despite what all the media will tell you. Like, Iran can't really rein them in. They can't tell them what to do, really. You know, they give them support in some ways, but they're their completely own thing. But it does seem like the risk of kind of the major regional war has gone down. So hopefully it stays that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that Raisi will be replaced by someone that might be considered more of a hardliner? I know you said that kind of the Ayatollah runs the government, but do you think there is the potential for somebody to come out and come on top and kind of say like, hey, we're not going to take Israel's shit anymore. And like, you know, we kind of want to have a more bold stance than we're kind of used to, because it seems like over the last couple decades, honestly, that Iran has always been, their foreign policy has always been characterized by a lot of restraint.
Yeah. I don't think we'll see that much of a difference. I mean, Raisi was considered to be a potential replacement for the Ayatollah. So I don't really know. I don't know enough about like internal Iranian politics to know who like the real players are right now. But I don't think we'll really see much of a change in the foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. I got you.
Unless if they do think like Israel might have had something to do with it, then they got to do something. But again, I don't see that an indication of that at this time.
Yeah, it seems like they almost have to walk, like Israel has to walk a tightrope with this whole situation, because they don't want to directly fight, you know, Iran and all them, because then Hezbollah, Lebanon, everybody has to get involved. But if they can get the U.S. involved, then they can kind of wash their hands of it and they know that they'll be okay. But, you know, once again, Israel has to find a way to kind of like make this all happen without, you know, directly going to war. So it's really, really interesting dynamic, but it almost seems like you're always like balancing a pin on your finger or something like that.
Yeah, no, there's been a lot of stuff in the past 7-8 months that could have been the thing that triggered like a real full blown war between the US and Iran. So, you know, it looks like the Iran's missile and drone attack on Israel was very calculated. Like, they basically told the U.S. 48 hours in advance. You know, it was very coordinated with the idea to prevent the big war. So hopefully that type of back channel communications continues.
Yeah, well, I remember when I had Leah, our friend Liam Cosgrove, on. I remember him saying, like, man, I really wish Biden was owned by China so that way we could get some kind of diplomacy. And it's the same deal with like Iran. I really wish that Biden was softer on Iran and, you know, as Ron DeSantis says, placating Iran so that way we get a little bit more diplomacy and hopefully cool shit off.
Well, that's another thing with Iran, with the, I mean, the Republicans are just completely hysterical about it. So like if Biden does anything diplomatically, it's just like they're just so over the top and just like hysterical about it. And that's because of Israel. You know, there's no real reason for the US and Iran to be enemies except for at this point. I mean, the US did, you know, it's the overthrow of the government, and that was kind of the main gripe they had with the US. But at this point, relations could be good, but it's Israel that keeps it this way. Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you and I probably come at this from the same perspective, but we'll wrap on this. Do you think there would be a significant difference between a Biden and Trump administration, or in the very, very slight situation of an RFK presidency? let's start with a Trump versus Biden presidency. Do you think there's going to be much difference? I think we're going to come to the same conclusion on this, though.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the foreign policy stuff, I don't think that there will be that much of a difference considering who might be in his cabinet, you know, because that's what really matters. You know, if Pompeo is anywhere involved, I think there's a chance that we see more of a focus on China, maybe winding down with Ukraine. But we might even see that with Biden. I mean, if he came in again, because realistically, they know that Ukraine is losing this thing, but they don't want to make them negotiate anything right now before November.
I wanted to share this before we got off.
Oh, yeah.
Nikki Haley says she will be voting for Trump. Yeah. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but to your point of who could be in a Trump administration.
Yeah. So, you know, fundamentally, I guess there might not really be much of a difference, because I do think with the situation in Ukraine, they want to keep it going for as long as they can. But realistically, it's not like a stalemate. It's Russia is winning and Russia is going to continue to win. We'll see. I mean, they're really asking for some crazy things now. Ukraine wants to use U.S. missiles to hit Russian territory. Right. They want NATO troops, and there's NATO countries that are saying they're willing to send troops. So there is a chance of the thing exploding, and maybe the Biden people will be more reckless when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. You know, chancing the idea of war with Russia, when the Trump people might be like, whoa, we got to save that for China. You know, let's take it easy with Russia a bit. I think that might be more of a difference, but I don't know. It's not good, whatever it is. And then the RFK, I mean, I don't think he has any chance, but let's say he did come in. I think he would end the war in Ukraine. He would probably be good on that. He might be, but you never know. I mean, who knows if what they can even really do. He's just Mr. Zionist, so that won't change. But I think he would probably be better on China. But you never know. There might be some reason why he wouldn't be. It would be tough to guess what would happen. Maybe he might just get shot. Because I do think he is enough, like, even though he's really bad on Israel and it doesn't make any sense. Like, if you watch the interview with Dave Smith, he's so, like, logical about Ukraine and like understand
everything, even China, he was like at least good with, at one point at least.
And then Israel's just like all logic and reason is out the window. It really does make you know, wonder some things, but
like Abrigati said, noticing, and once again, not this isn't the podcast for that, I just don't know, but like when you see stuff like that, it's like you guys aren't doing like us any favors here. We're trying to just be like, yeah, the state of Israel and the government there is bad. But then it's like RFK will literally, he shared an article that you wrote from antiwar.com, didn't he? Yeah.
A couple, actually.
Yeah. So like, how can you read that, but then just on Israel, just out to lunch? Like, how does that work?
Yeah.
It's weird, man. So I know you do lots of big shows and cool stuff. Feel free to plug anything if you got anything cool coming up from the future. Let everybody know where they could find you, listen to your show, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, follow me on X at DeCampDave. All my writings at antiwar.com, and you can listen to my show, Anti-War News, which is like the daily kind of rundown of all the stuff I write. It's on YouTube or Rumble or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Nice. Any big appearances coming up soon for you?
No, got nothing scheduled. Potentially something with the Ron Paul Institute, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. This one last super chat, then we'll close there. Epstein probably explains RFK.
Well, he did flying the plane. Yeah,
and he did, and he was on the news, and he seemed like he didn't have any hesitation saying that he did that either. I'm like, man, that is a bad look. Just saying, yeah, I flew on the plane. Like,
yeah,
I'd probably bury that shit down, man.
Yeah, I guess he knows it's out there. So,
yeah, I mean, at least he owned it. So, well, anyways, Dave, if you don't got anything else, we'll close her out there.
Yeah, that's it.
Nice. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for the super chats. And feel free, everybody, to message me with your thoughts about memberships. I think I'm going to start that. So anyways, Dave, thank you so much. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. And until next time, take care.